Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why top colleges aren't doing enough to recruit students of color, and the numbers tell the story. The percentage of first-year students who are African-American at elite colleges has barely budged in more than 30 years. A New York Times analysis this summer revealed that only 5% of top colleges' freshman class are Black, quite low when you consider that 15% of the overall freshman class is African-American, and Hispanic students are also lagging at top schools. So what's going on? Why aren't elite colleges going after more students of color? And where do affirmative action policies fit into this? And here's another question. Why aren't more students of color graduating in time from four-year institutions, including these top colleges, these top institutions? We're going to consider all of this with our guests. And I hope you'll give this some thought and weigh into the show. If you're a college student or a college grad of color, did you attend a school that was mostly white? And that may very well be the case here in Minnesota. Did you find that school welcoming and invested in your success? And then I'm also reaching out to educators today. If you're an educator in high school or college, what do you think could make a difference in getting more students of color into selective school? So I'm asking today to hear about your personal experience as a college student or a college grad of color or a student who went to a college that was mostly white. What did you see the school doing to try to bring in more diverse students? And if you're an educator in high school or college, what do you think could make a difference in getting more students of color into selective schools? 651-227-6000. Here, the number, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Dr. Andrew Nichols is with us. He's Director of Higher Education and Data Analytics at the Education Trust, and he's with us today from Washington, D.C. And Andrew, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. Nice to be here.
Dr. Gregory Anderson is with us. He's Dean of the College of Education at Temple University, and he's with us today from Philly. And Drew and Greg, our first names all right. I hear they are. And if that's okay with you, that's how we'll go.
Absolutely, in my case.
Okay, great.
That's fine with me.
Drew, dig into the numbers a bit more with me here. How can it be that in 35 years since around 1980, the numbers of African-American and Hispanic students at these top colleges has barely moved? I thought these colleges were paying attention to this. What's happened?
Well, you'd hope they would be paying attention to this. And I think that New York Times piece laid it out brilliantly, looking at, you know, the percentage of Black and Latino students at really elite private institutions, elite liberal art institutions, and public flagship institutions. And really what they found is that over that 35-year period, Black students are still underrepresented at these elite institutions, and so are Latino students. And so you had Black students representing about 5% of, undergraduates enrolled at these institutions, mm-hmm. but they represent about 15% of college-aged adults in this country. And you also had Latino students, representing about 11% of students or undergraduates at these institutions, even though they represent about 22% of college-aged undergraduates, across the nation or, college-aged adults. And so essentially, this is a challenge that we've seen even in our own work. We looked at, elite research institutions across the country, and we saw these same results. And so this is a challenge that we are having, and we're not quite sure what the problem is in terms of why colleges and universities can't actively recruit more Black and Latino students. And also, I'd like to talk a bit later about why they're having challenges helping these students complete.
Good. Absolutely. Key part of the conversation, I think. So, Greg, I think we ought to note that the percentage of students of colors in all colleges has definitely increased. That's good news. So again, then it makes us turn attention to what aren't the top elite colleges doing that other schools are to bring in more students of color. What's your sense of that?
Well, I mean, the first thing to take note is, yes, the college rate in terms of students of color
are increasing. But if you actually look at where they're proportionally increasing, it's happening at the two-year institutional level, not necessarily always at the four-year institutional level, and particularly when we're talking about elite institutions. I think, you know, there are a couple of factors. One is that we still have structural inequality, and the inequality that exists in the K through 12 systems, where students of color disproportionately are found, and that impacts their access to elite institutions. I think the other thing is the behavior of elite institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you look, we're all in competition with each other. And so, you know, go to a website, and the first thing you'll see is, you know, your ACT and SAT scores have gone up. This is the most qualified incoming cohort, et cetera. So the ways in which we admit students, and particularly the use of standardized tests, actually diminish the opportunity for students that have great potential, students of color, but aren't going to meet those increasing threshold standards.
This is interesting, Drew, and I was reading about this, too much focus on these standardized tests. What else should and could be considered if we were going to reduce the emphasis on the standardized test towards the end of bringing more students of color into these top colleges?
Sure. It's not just SAT scores or standardized test scores that are causing the issue. Certainly that is part of it, and you see that SAT scores are correlated with income and that Black and Latino students tend to score lower. There's also evidence that the SAT is biased, particularly in the verbal section in terms of, you know, Black and Latino students just responding to items differently,
mm-hmm.
In ways that aren't based upon, you know, the actual skill set.
That makes sense. That's one issue. Yeah.
And the other issue is around grades. And so, you know, it obviously makes sense for colleges to consider grades in the admissions process, but there's been recent research that's come out that talks about grade inflation, and they're seeing that grades are going up, but actual SAT scores are going down.
Really?
And so it suggests that it's really not people becoming smarter or getting better. They're actually just, it's just grade inflation. But the problem is that this grade inflation isn't uniform across all schools.
Hmm.
Grade inflation is happening mostly at places where students tend to be mostly white and wealthy. So that is also a systemic issue. And then if you think about the types of offerings that are provided at different high schools, you see that Black and Latino students disproportionately attend schools where they don't offer rigorous courses that help you become college ready.
Yeah.
And so these are some of the challenges. And then you also have to think about a lot of these institutions are still practicing legacy admissions,
uh-huh.
where they're letting students get additional points because their parents or someone in their family graduated from the institution. And then there's extracurricular activities.
Drew, let me say this about the legacy here. It's a good point because if you are a first-generation college student in your family, you're already automatically at a disadvantage. And I'm aware that a lot of schools are doing that.
Yeah, it's still a common practice. It's something that, you know, colleges should really stop doing immediately. It's just a complete disadvantage to first-generation folks or people from low-income backgrounds.
For sure.
As well. And so, and we know that disproportionately affects Black and Latino students who certainly are going to more likely be first-generation
yeah.
or low-income.
Let me take some calls here. We have a number of people on the line to Ashley in Minneapolis. Ashley, it sounds like you've had some experience with this. Hi.
Hi. I went to a school where it was mostly white, and me and my best friend, who's African American, also who also has a disability,
mm-hmm.
was with me. And we just struggled through our 4 years of college. I was in nursing school, and she's also in nursing school. But I noticed that to the African American disabled folks, the school did not really support them, and they just like I feel like they treated them like an outcast. Kind of, even though she had a good GPA, an ACT score, SAT score. She was in a, you know, nursing program that was really hard to get into, but they still treated her as a, you know, outcast.
This sounds like this was pretty isolating. Were you and your friend able to graduate from the school, or did you end up transferring somewhere?
We ended up graduating from that school, but throughout those 4 years, we we complained a lot. We talked to the principal of the school. You know, they would always say that we're working on it, we're going to help you, whatever. But they just never did. And, you know, we just gave up at the end of the day. And I feel like that's really hard, especially when we're minorities and, you know, and my best friend has a disability, which yeah. is really hard.
Ashley, I appreciate the call because this is something that I wanted to talk about. And Greg, you being at Temple, I'd be interested to hear what the responsibility, the obligation, and the investment in success of bringing in students of color doesn't end the day they get admitted or the day they show up on campus, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Look, it's a necessary but insufficient condition to ensure success. And I think higher ed institutions are starting to address the issue of completion more seriously. But there are a host of factors. One, as you mentioned, isolation. Now, predominantly white institutions, if you're a student of color, you tend to sort of stick out. Just numerically, you really are a minority when we're talking about numbers. So as a result, you tend not to feel the same kind of sense of belonging. And then when you factor in if you're a first-generation student, and there's a strong correlation between many students of color, particularly from low-income backgrounds, and their first-generation status, you have no reference points to college. Right. You feel like, I know how I felt. I felt like I was lost in a supermarket. There were lots of options, but I didn't know which product to take or which one was better. And I think so you get that. And then the reality is we're all competing with each other, right? I mean, you know, higher education is particularly competitive. You're supposed to be in a meritocratic situation. So it's hard to admit that you need help
when
you'd have to admit that potentially that could make you look less competitive.
Greg, did you go to school at Temple?
I did not.
Okay.
I actually, my parents are from South Africa,
and
they weren't allowed to go to university.
Uh-huh.
And then we ended up in Canada. And so I have a pretty interesting history, and then I ended up doing my doctoral work in New York. So I've experienced this in multiple countries and in multiple institutional types, too.
Drew, how about you? Did you experience this in your own education experience?
Absolutely. As a black man who went to three predominantly white institutions, I had similar experiences that the young lady shared on the phone. You know, when you're black on a predominantly white campus, you deal with a lot of different things. You know, one of the things that we haven't mentioned is the fact that there are few faculty members and few administrators on many of these campuses who look like you.
Oh, well, good point.
And oftentimes will take an interest in you, help develop you, help you learn your way up on campus, how to navigate different challenges that exist and challenges that you encounter. So that's one piece. But the other piece is just strictly racism. I mean, we have not really addressed racism very well in this country. We don't teach it well, so we don't acknowledge our racial history as well as some of the current, you know, inequalities that exist. And so you deal with all types of things. And this is really prevalent in the higher education research literature. It talks about black students and Latino students encountering issues with racial slurs, encountering challenges with seeing kind of racist symbols such as nooses being found on campus and
right.
things of that nature.
We've seen incidences of that fairly recently, I'm sad to say.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it happens year after year. We have incidents of white students dressing up in Halloween and putting on blackface in ways that are, you know, offensive to everyone, particularly black students. And you deal with the daily microaggressions and stereotypes that people thinking that, you know, for me, I'm a 6'2 male. I went to Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. I often got asked if I was a football player or a basketball
player. I'm sure.
Yeah. And I wasn't. I was just there to study like everyone else. And so, you know, just basic stereotypes about who you are, why you're there, and what you can and can't do. And this it takes a toll over time.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about why it is that in the last 30 to 35 years, the numbers of students of color, particularly African-American and Latino students, have not really budged when you look at enrollment at top colleges. I guess we haven't really answered the question of why it matters that we're really only examining the top colleges here, and I can ask our guests about that. But it is also a measure of what's happening in colleges and universities across the country. Why aren't more of these top students being recruited to top colleges? What's going on in high schools? I mean, we know this is a guidance counselor issue here in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to hear from you, if you're a college student or college grad of color, whether you attended a school that was mostly white. And I want to know whether that school was welcoming and invested in your success, or did you have an experience, as we heard from our first caller, who said, yeah, we got there, we felt pretty isolated, we complained, the school didn't really respond. If you're an educator in high school or college, what do you think would really make a difference to address this? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, And on Twitter, a listener says, graduated from Hamline in May 2017, thought we had a healthy mix of diversity. Yeah, are you seeing change coming to the college that you graduated from or that you're in now? It's at Carrie MPR on Twitter. To Jesus in St. Paul, hey, good morning, and thanks for waiting. Curious to hear what you have to say. Hi.
Sure. Hi. Yeah, I'm an educator of teachers, and I'm also in the midst of finishing my Bachelor of Science.
Excellent.
As a brown Latino. Uh-huh. What I'm coming to realize right now is that towards the end, even though there's a lot of organizations that tout mission statements like getting diversity in the teaching area, there isn't anybody to assist me. I've contacted multiple institutions, organizations about helping me with my last of my financial aid or the last for paying for my classes, and I have gotten nothing but crickets. So I find it interesting that there's organizations that are able, or nonprofits, to create a profit or create institutions that are out there that are touting these mission statements. Mm-hmm. But here I am, only going to be the fifth licensed biology teacher, Latino biology teacher in the whole state of Minnesota, and I can't find anybody to assist me with the last $1,400 worth of debt that I have right now for my last assignment. Oh. I think that's really sad, considering what we need.
Greg, what would you say about that?
Well, I mean, that's a reoccurring problem. I mean, one of the biggest issues we have in teacher education is being able to populate new teachers from communities of color. And actually, it's related to something that I call the scarcity value, okay? Like, so it's not totally accurate to say that elite institutions don't recruit students of color. They do. They recruit the same students of color. That's the problem.
What do you mean? It's like one small pool or what?
Yes, it's a very small pool in terms of their threshold standards. We're talking very high standardized scores, very high GPAs, which means access to AP courses, which increases your GPA.
Okay.
We're talking also very high class ranks. So when you then factor in all of those criteria, you will find that the pool of students of color that meet that criteria is quite small. And so they'll get 15, 20 offers. But the problem with respect to teacher education is we're talking about a field that is A, under attack, right? B, is going to pay decently, but not as well as an engineer, for example, mm-hmm. or a doctor. And so it's really hard to recruit in those fields, particularly students of color who, if they are fortunate enough to be in a good institution of higher education, and by that I mean quality, right?
Mm-hmm.
However we define that, they're going to have so many options that teaching isn't one of the options that they'll pursue. So it's a real difficult task for us. The other piece is financial aid. It's very difficult in this environment to target financial aid to students of color without the possibility of being challenged legally.
You mean because that is looked on as an affirmative action policy?
Yes. And higher education institutions, by their very nature, while they are viewed as liberal institutions, are quite traditional institutions, so they're risk averse. So anytime there's a legal challenge or potential legal challenge, it's really a hard sell for a university to openly embrace, access measures with respect to financial aid that target students of color. It can be done in a very targeted way, like STEM, for example, when we're talking about the numbers being so small, mm-hmm. science, technology, engineering, and medicine or math, right? But it's very difficult to do at a large scale because universities are scared.
Drew, I feel like I should make the point here because I have a lot of conversations about college readiness and college success. You can get a very, very good education at many schools outside of the most selective top, I don't know, 100 or so. And we really ought to say you should choose a school that fits you, not for its name brand. And how about you should choose a school that has an open record of being welcoming to students of color, even if still predominantly the student body is white. Would you add something to that?
No, I think that's right. You certainly want to, identify an institution that's a good fit for you in terms of the culture on that particular campus. Also, the types of offerings they provide in terms of major selection are really important. But black students, Latino students also need to pay attention to the outcomes and graduation rates of these particular institutions. That's something that matters quite a bit. And so we encourage students to try to get into the best school they can. I say best in terms of the one that gives you the best chance of graduating. And so what we look at in our work is how similar colleges oftentimes have very different outcomes for the same types of students.
Really?
And so you can see a college, have 20 percentage point difference in their graduation rate for black students when on its surface, those particular institutions look exactly the same when it comes to the percentage or share of low-income students they serve, the median or average SAT score at that institution, enrollment size, and resources. And so it tells you it's not just simply about, you know, what students bring with them to campus. It's also about what leaders on that particular campus do with and for the students they serve. Mm. And so this is one of the points that I want to make is that we need higher education leaders to be more bold. We need them not to simply just chase prestige, you know, by looking for students who essentially have the highest SAT score or rank highest in their class. We need these institutions to take on the role of being engines of social mobility, mm-hmm. right, and serve
right.
the disenfranchised. We want our public institutions in particular to look like the nation.
That seems like the highest purpose, I would think.
It is in our minds. To us, that is a good institution, an institution that doesn't necessarily just take, and I'm putting this in air quotes, the best and brightest, but take students who maybe didn't get a fair shake or have been kind of systemically cheated in their K-12 experience and turn that person into a productive citizen, who goes on to do great things in society.
Dr. Andrew Nichols, by the way, with us, if you've just tuned in and you're hearing this conversation, he's director of higher education and data analytics at the Education Trust. And Dr. Gregory Anderson with us. He's dean of the College of Education at Temple University, a discussion, if you've just gotten in, where we're talking about why it is that the numbers of African-American and Latino students at top selective schools really haven't budged remarkably in 30 or 35 years. And we're examining what's going on with that. I don't want to leave you with the impression that's the only way to get a good education. It's not. But this says something about where we're at in higher education, which is why we're talking about. We're also going to talk about graduation rates. What happens when students of color get on campus? We see the numbers. They're not graduating in 4 years as their white counterparts are. So we'll talk about that as well. Chris says on Twitter, at my former campus, we were able to cut the achievement gap in half by addressing issues of belonging and advocacy for students. It takes time, but it's doable. To Bart, listening in Minneapolis. Hi, Bart. Thanks so much for waiting. What's your experience with this?
Hey, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Sure.
So I'm African-American male, born and raised in North Minneapolis, went to Breck for middle school, mm-hmm. Minneapolis North for high school. Then I went to Howard University, a predominantly African-American university, and now I'm currently an MBA student at the University of St. Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons why students of color are not interested in the elite institutions is it comes down to racism, culture, support, cost, and location. And I think that as our nation continues to diversify, I don't think that we necessarily place the same amount of value on going to the Ivies to be higher educated. And so I think that's definitely something that needs to be considered in addition to a standardized testing and the values and the culture within those institutions.
I'm so glad you called because this is a note that I had to talk about this. And so this gives us a moment to do that, Bart. Thanks. Greg, we've seen an increase in enrollment in historically black higher education institutions, haven't we? Is that, what do you think of what Bart's analysis is of that? And is that a reaction to what's happening with some of these selective schools?
Yeah, it is. Look, I mean, there are many wonderful institutions that aren't described as research ones or elite institutions, Ivy League institutions. And in fact, they're doing the brunt of the real democratizing work in this country. The problem, though, is when you look at higher education as a system, those are the institutions, particularly minority-serving institutions, that are the most under-resourced and under threat in terms of support from the state, et cetera. So, you know, while the real bandwidth of opportunity is existing in the public institutional sphere, those institutions are struggling to compete in an increasingly competitive environment where, you know, dollars are driving, the quality of the educational opportunity afforded students. So I completely applaud to your institutions and for your publics. I mean, look, Temple is a public state-related institution. It's a research one institution with a college access and an access mission, historic access mission. And there are ways in which our institution have changed in order to meet the demands of access. So, for example, we have a way of getting into the university called the Temple Option that does not require standardized test scores to be submitted. And then we evaluate the students on the basis of what they call grit, or these non-cognitive attributes like persistence, leadership, communication skills, et cetera, that can be measured, statistically mm-hmm. measured,
uh-huh.
that we use to give opportunity to students that deserve it because they have the great potential. They just haven't had the kind of resource base required for them to look like the students that we want to take bets on.
And when you initiated that, Greg, what kind of difference did you see in the students that were coming to campus?
We saw an immediate difference. First of all, we saw, you know, one of the positive things about bringing students of diverse backgrounds, broadly defined, is they change the culture of the college,
right.
of the university. They change the nature of the student body. They change the nature of student leadership. So, and we also saw, interestingly, though, students that are going into majors that they wouldn't have gone prior to because they would have been excluded because of those high threshold standards. Now, the issue is that you raised is how well are we supporting them when they get you?
Right.
And that really is still, I think, a big challenge for higher education institutions because we really focus on bringing them in, kind of like a hook, but we have to focus on finishing them. And that requires resources. So going back to the idea of public institutions that are carrying the brunt of opportunity, they have to have the resources required to help those students that are first-generation students that are going to suffer from some of the things that we talked about by no fault of their own. They're just not used to being in that environment. And that requires resources. And that's what I worry about when we start pointing at the public institutions, the non-elites, and saying, well, look, we're meeting access. That's true, but we need to meet access across the entire higher education system.
Mm-hmm. On Twitter here, a listener says, I'm Native American, 0.06% college students. I didn't know that. I'm really glad you tweeted that in. They say, please don't forget us, especially in Minnesota. Noted, and thank you for sending that out during this discussion. To Maria in Minneapolis. Hi, Maria. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi.
What's your story?
Yes, thank you. I actually grew up in a smaller town in Minnesota, but now I live in Minneapolis. But I'm actually going to school in Wisconsin, and my biggest thing was I didn't have the best ACT score. I applied to a lot of schools as a freshman this year, like the St. Thomas's and the St. Ben's and all that. I decided to go with a STEM school in Wisconsin because I want to go into medicine.
Good.
And I thought I would have, and it's not a real expensive school, you know, it's one of those state U's, and I thought I would have a lot more help financially. I got a lot of the government loans, but I still ended up with like an $8,000 bill that I had to have paid the first year.
Wow.
So my parents were great. My mom went to college. My dad did not. He's the Latino side of my family. She's actually Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's $8,000 we're trying to figure out. And if I had that bill next year, I don't know if I can do that. Well, I'm told, you know, we did the best we can with your aid package. And there's lots of stuff out there you can apply for scholarships. And it's like I don't have time to sit and try to – I've gone to a couple of sites to try to figure out how to do it. And
right.
It's like, wow, this is overwhelming. Can't you tell me where those scholarship places are? And if I can't – if I'm going to have an $8,000 bill next year, I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like
– wow.
I think a lot of it is financial. You know, I can do this. The classes are great. I'm doing really well in school. I've got great friends. But I don't know if I can do 8,000 year after year after year. You know, I don't think people realize, plus the loans, and by the time you get out, you have to pay the loans back.
Right.
It's crazy, you know.
Andrew, Maria, I'm really glad you called. I think your experience is, you know, a lot of the students who are listening here are having that experience, too. So, Drew, I mean, we would never want Maria to have to drop out of school for $8,000 a year. What's the answer?
Well, you know, if you look at the data, they talk about how affordability is the number one reason students report, you know, dropping out of school or not graduating. And this is just a serious issue that affects lots of students. What we've seen over the past several decades is states are not investing in higher education the same way they did 30 and 40 years ago. And they're shifting the burden to individuals and family members. And so that's why you've seen the cost of college rise at a rate higher higher than inflation and at a rate higher than healthcare costs over the past couple of decades. And so this is a problem that's consistent across the board for everyone. And, you know, we're trying to encourage states to invest more in higher education. It's tough because they have competing priorities. And we're also trying to advocate for the federal government to improve the Pell Grant. The Pell Grant now covers perhaps the lowest percentage of college costs than it has ever. It used to cover 75%. Now it's down to like 30% or 40%. 30% at public 4-year college and universities. And so affordability is one of the biggest issues. The second issue is really what we were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, students not feeling welcomed on their particular campus. And I also appreciate the gentleman calling in talking about Native American students. If you look at graduation rates across the country, you'll see that Black students and Native American students graduated about 40% compared to white students at about 60% and Latino students around 50% or so.
Greg, I'm still thinking about Maria here. Is there some specific suggestion you can make, maybe resources she hasn't thought of?
You know, there are a host of resources that you really require a lot of time in order to dig up. You know, this is going to sound terrible, but the best way to force a university to look at your financial situation is to hound them with multiple complaints. Look, when
really?
Affluent parents,
okay.
Yes, because you see that happening actually with affluent parents before once their students are admitted, but before they enroll, they're already actually pushing for greater financial aid packages. And you'd be surprised, you know, it's kind of a dirty trade secret how much wiggle room there is if a student is diligent and attacks the problem from multiple points. Now, here's the problem, though, right? You're a student, a first-generation student. You're already insecure about going. Mm. Your parents don't have any clue of what university life is like. They don't feel empowered to necessarily make that phone call on your behalf if you're an undergraduate. So you don't even think that that's an option for you. And I would just want to reiterate about the Pell Grants, absolutely correct, that if you actually look at rates of inflation and then compare it to how the Pell Grant has increased, it's actually the gap has gotten even larger in terms of the affordability. And the other issue that the Pell Grant doesn't address at all is that students have to live when they go to – it isn't just the cost of tuition.
Right. Yep.
They have to live.
Right.
And those students are working. A lot of the low-income students, students of color in particular, are working in order to make the difference between what they can afford and can't afford to go to school. And that also diminishes their graduation rates and heightens the attrition rates. So it's kind of unfortunately like a perfect storm of things.
Can I add something as well?
Yeah, Drew.
We also need to encourage institutions to invest more in need-based financial aid and step away from awarding merit-based financial aid to people who really have the ability to pay.
Yeah.
And so there also is an institutional responsibility here to put their resources towards the students who need it the most.
Why are we still talking about that? I mean, you know, colleges have seen this for a long time. They've seen that their tuition rates are outpacing what students can afford. Why aren't they doing what you've just suggested?
Well, they know that higher education is a good that everyone needs, so they're charging what the market will bear.
Okay.
But part of it is they're also chasing prestige. They're all trying to climb the rankings, particularly U.S. News and World Report rankings.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing this, you know that if you attract the best and brightest and most prepared students who have the highest SAT scores, who have the highest high school graduating class rank, you're able to climb that ladder in prestige. And that leads to other things in terms of wealth and promotions for individuals and things of that nature. So part of it is their own self-interest being put above the interests of students, particularly the most vulnerable who aren't able to pay.
I like how we're saying it like it is here, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. It's good to have you on the show. This is a conversation about what's going on with students of color, particularly African American, Native American, Hispanic students at selective colleges. We've talked about, are they welcoming? Are they out there recruiting? Are they changing policies to make sure that they are broadening their diverse populations? Are they looking beyond just an ACT or SAT score? All of that's come up in the conversation. And I'm asking you, if you're a college student or a college grad of color, did you attend a school that was mostly white? Are you encountering some of the things that we're talking about this morning? If you get a busy signal, call us back. We have a lot of people waiting here. And educators, I want to hear from you on this as well. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at CarrieNPR, where a listener says, I'm a 33-year-old African-American female, grew up in a 95% white city, went to a predominantly white college. Most of my friends were non-white students from predominantly white cities or neighborhoods like me. We didn't feel comfortable at all at black schools, nor did we fit in at our school. We made our own niche. Andrew Nichols is with us, Director of Higher Education and Data and Analytics at the Education Trust, and Gregory Anderson with us, Dean of the College of Education at Temple University. I want to grab some calls, gentlemen, but I want to make sure, don't let me forget to talk about graduation rates, okay? We'll
sure.
definitely come back to that. To
right.
Sarah in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And Sarah, I know it's been a while. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, no problem. So I'm addressing a comment Dr. Nichols made towards the beginning of this conversation. We're
sure.
talking about getting into elite universities. I went to a top 10 elite college. I'm involved in their admissions and as an alumni and stay abreast of it. So they have changed to completely need blind, first of all, as have almost all top 20 universities in the nation now are completely need blind. They don't even look at that in admissions. But Dr. Nichols had talked about how it was an unfair process because of legacies getting an extra point in the admissions process. But we need to keep that in perspective because first-generation college students are also getting extra points. They're specifically seeking out students that are first-generation college students as well as, of course, minorities. So if you are a qualified first-generation college student or a qualified minority, mm-hmm. you are going to be accepted. I mean, they are so, their mission statement is, you know, they are so interested and committed to having that diverse campus and having not just racially, but also with people from different backgrounds, that if you are qualified, you will be able to afford to go and you will be admitted.
But I think what we've been talking about, and Drew, please step in here, is how we look at that quote unquote qualification.
Absolutely. So I guess my question would be, how do we define qualified? And I think we've talked about, you know, SAT scores, high school grades, and things of that nature. And I did mention to some extent how those things systemically disadvantage maybe sometimes people of color or people from low-income backgrounds. But, you know, when we're thinking about really the larger context in which this is situated, we have to think about what's happening in our society. And so the reality is you can have a different experience based upon the color of your skin in this country. And if you look at socioeconomic indicators, you'll see that, you know, black and Latino people oftentimes are dealt a different, you know, a subpar hand. We talk about the wealth gap between white families and black and Latino families. In particular, the white families have 12 times more assets than black families. We talk about the percentage of black children who are living in poverty. And so about 34% of black and about 28% of Latinos children are living in poverty compared to just 12% of white children. And if you think about, you know, the American dream, the reality is that isn't attainable for everyone. And so 60% of black kids who are born poor will be poor as adults compared to just 30% of white kids. And so what we argue is that the best chance to kind of escape these conditions is through higher education in earning a degree. And if you look at the data, what you see is that between adults who are between the ages of 25 and 34, about 43% of white adults have a bachelor's degree. That's compared to about 24% of black adults and about 17% of Latino adults. But if you think about it, in 1975, the attainment rate for white adults was where it is for black people today,
wow.
at 25%. So you have to think about the context in which all this is situated, and those conditions make it more difficult for black, Latino, and low-income people to develop a quote-unquote qualified application portfolio, right? And so if you think about those socioeconomic conditions along with some of the systemic K-12 inequities, the reality is it's not a level playing field. So we're pushing for colleges and universities to perhaps be a bit more aggressive with their affirmative action policies.
If Sarah, I think you're still there on the line.
Yes.
Did I hear you right when you said that these institutions are going completely need blind? Do I interpret
absolutely.
That the way it sounds?
It means that when you apply, the admissions officers do not know if you need financial aid or not.
What?
So they accept that. And then if you are accepted and you do need financial aid, they have committed to make sure you will be able to go to their school, regardless of your financial need.
Greg, what do you think of that?
Well, that's like, in my view, that's a reverse equitable arrangement.
How so?
In the sense that, look, there is a correlation between socioeconomic status and standardized test scores. In fact, the strongest correlation between high standardized test scores are high socioeconomic status of the student and the parents. The second correlation involves first-year grades. So the reality is that it's fine to say that in a wealthy institution that you can go need blind. But the N, as in the number of students that would qualify from low-income, especially low-income student of color backgrounds, is so small that, of course, these institutions can afford to give them a complete free ride if they qualify, right? The problem is the big opportunity is in that middle bandwidth. Mm-hmm. In which we are not talking about potential because we're talking about qualifications. There are so many people across all sorts of groups that could go to college that have the ability to, but don't look like it on paper because of the under-resources that occurred in their K-12 experience. Like, don't you think it's absurd that if I don't have an AP course or a set of AP courses I can take, immediately my GPA can't be higher
than in
a place in which which the courses are available.
Completely unfair.
Right, that's got nothing to do with my ability.
Right.
I can't take a course that isn't offered in my high school. That's an inequity. So I get the qualifications, but we hide too much around qualifications without acknowledging that, as Drew said, that we don't start at the same line.
Yeah, and I think Greg is onto something here about the need blind policy.
Yeah,
that's actually the opposite of what we want institutions to do. We want them to look at your application, look at the situation in which you were raised, look at your socioeconomic status, and actually award you preferential treatment based upon that. What we don't want institutions doing is making decisions around if we'll admit you based upon how much money we would have to pay you to be able to afford to come to this institution. And so I think it's a little bit more nuanced than need blind necessarily being a good thing. We certainly want them to actually look at your application, look at your socioeconomic status, and provide you preferential treatment so that you can gain admission into that institution.
Krista says on Twitter, I'm an Asian American and graduated from an MIAC school several years ago. It was mostly white, and it seemed like most of the students of color were from abroad. And then she adds, when speaking of students of color, please remember the phrase also includes Asian Americans. Greg, let's dig into graduation rates here. Mm-hmm. And I want you to know we've done a number of shows about this, so I don't want you to think we're coming to this lately. But the numbers are also pretty disappointing, pretty discouraging about what happens. They lag by double-digit percentages, the graduation rates of white students. Is that mostly about money?
It's not just about money. It's about resources writ large. So in other words, we can't pretend that all high schools are created equal. So if your class rank was in the top 1% in a high school that's in a really affluent area versus a high school that's in a very poor area, the quality of your preparation is going to be different. I mean, that's not a radical statement, right? So when you come to the college or university, immediately you're treated as if everyone is the same in terms of, I might have had the exact same GPA, right? But the reality is that I haven't had the level of preparation, so I'm catching up immediately. Now, we also don't like set-asides in higher education because we're scared of the legal challenges that set-asides might bring to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, we don't like to have tailor-made programs that would focus on students that might need additional help because we're labeling them, quote-unquote. So in the name of not labeling them, we don't always create programs that are targeting them.
I see.
So that's another problem, right? And so it becomes the situation in which we congratulate ourselves for bringing in students, but we need to actually put more resources into finishing those students and acknowledging when they're struggling. And that requires an entirely different way of thinking about how we educate. Because when we educate, we tend to educate in individual disciplines, individual colleges, et cetera. We're talking about educational support across the university, which is a much harder sort of approach because it's not targeting one particular area of study or major. It's actually focusing on the whole student body.
Drew, I was reading some of the statistics that have come out from the Education Trust, and I see that you report that only about 4 in 10 Black students who start college as freshmen graduate with a degree in 6 years, 22% below the rate that white students graduate. We've discussed how the financial part of this figures into that. What else do you say to that?
Yeah, it's a combination of some of the things that Greg mentioned in terms of academic preparation. Certainly, you know, Black students aren't provided with the same type of K-12 opportunities as their white peers are, so they start off a bit behind. And then they're certainly going to campuses, oftentimes predominantly white campuses, where they, you know, don't necessarily feel as if they fit in or if they matter at those particular campuses.
Right.
They don't necessarily have the support systems in terms of, you know, more additional students who look like them there to help them support themselves in terms of peer support, but also faculty and staff support. If you look at the percentage of faculty members who are African-American, a lot of these campuses, they're extremely low. Also, if you're looking at staff, you'll see that percentage is low as well. So that's a piece of it. And I like Greg's approach in terms of the types of targeted services that are needed to really, like, you know, specifically focus on students who we know may struggle to finish at that particular campus.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not all leaders are going to take that approach.
Right.
And so that was really the comment I was making earlier around, you know, different institutions have different track records of success with Black students.
Yep.
And so even though there's a 20 percentage point gap nationally, if you look at how different institutions fare with regard to their ability to complete Black students compared to their ability to complete white students, it varies drastically. And so you have about a quarter of institutions that have a gap above 20 percentage points and another 20% that have a gap between 15 and 20 percentage points. But
wow.
We also see that about 1 in 5 have a gap below 5, right? Below 5 percentage points.
Sorry.
That's a gap in terms of the Black graduation rate.
So what are they doing? Right.
Yeah, what are they
yeah.
doing? Exactly. And so our opinion is that it's not just about the students and what the students are struggling to do and the challenges they have to overcome. It's also really about, you know, what is the president on that campus value? What is the provost value? How are the faculty engaged and committed to student success? What types of programs are they offering? Because there's this institutional factor that we don't talk about enough that matters a great deal.
I want to make sure we get Ephraim in from St. Paul here because he's raising an important point. Hi, thank you so much for waiting, Ephraim. What'd you want to say?
Yeah, I was actually interested for people of color, students of color, getting into and accepted into higher institutions. It seems as though academic advisors, oftentimes even in high school, are saying you aren't going to be able to do this. You might as well just not apply.
Mm-hmm.
So the rates at which African Americans are in these Ivy League schools and in these higher institutions is not going to be as high if they're not actually applying to them.
Yeah. Greg, do you think this is, I have about a minute and a half left here, but steering students of color into community colleges or technical colleges or what?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. It's well, first of all, there's been a complete attrition of counselors in low-resourced school districts. And when they are available, they're usually dealing with, quote-unquote, behavioral issues. So there really isn't in many, particularly urban, but also rural districts, actual counselors anymore that focus on college access. So and that's an absolute truth, right? And then there's the other issue of, look, if I'm nervous about going to higher ed and I'm scared about what a standardized test score because I've never done one or I've never felt I'm good at it, then a community college doesn't require it. And all those kinds of things that we're talking about in terms of affirmative action doesn't apply because it's a universal access institution. So, you know, you get this kind of notion of tracking, you know, that what the lower the expectations, the counselors are overwhelmed. It's easier for them to point to two-year institutions as a pathway to college and to workforce development opportunities. And so we kind of don't look at the potential of our students, which if you think from the point of view of the nation, is a really dumb way to have an educational policy because we need the entire population to continue to improve.
I've really learned a lot from you both and from our callers today. Thanks, Greg. Thank you, Drew. Thanks for the good conversation.
Thank you very much.